In by way of introduction for our meeting tonight, some of you saw this in the televised debate, presidential debate, and Donald Trump, love him or hate him, I mean, I don't trust the man myself, but he says a lot of good things, said this about vaccinations the other day, and we're going to play a 60-second clip here on that. And I think you'll get a
kick
out of this.
There have been numerous studies, and they have not demonstrated that there's any correlation between vaccinations and autism. This was something that was spread widely 15 or 20 years ago, and it has not been.
Institutes of Health, both of which say you are wrong. How would you handle this as president?
Autism has become an epidemic. 25 years ago, 35 years ago, you look at the statistics, not even close. It has gotten totally out of control. I am totally in favor of vaccines, but I want smaller doses over a longer period of time. Because you take a baby in, and I've seen it, and I've seen it, and I had my children taken care of over a long period of time, over a 2 or 3 year period of time, same exact amount. But you take this little beautiful baby, and you pump, I mean, it looks just like it's meant for a horse, not for a child. And we've had so many instances, people that worked for me just the other day, 2 years old, 2.5 years old, a child, a beautiful child, went to have the vaccine and came back and a week later got a tremendous fever, got very, very sick, now is autistic. I only say it's not, I'm in favor of vaccines. Do them over a longer period of time, same amount.
Thank you.
Just in little sections.
Dr. Cronson.
Okay. So the figure he was referring to was 30 years ago, the rates of autism in children was 1 in 25,000. 1 in 25,000. Who knows what it is today? 1 in 68. Sir, if I had another gold coin, I'd give it to you tonight, but 1 in 68. They estimate that by the year 2025, which sounds like a long time away, but guess what? We're almost in 16, so it's only 9 years off. They estimate it'll be 1 in 2. Yes, ma'am, you're well read. This is not an anti, we're not here tonight as anti-vaxxers or pro-vaxxers, and I know you're going to have some people in here on both sides of the fence, but I would argue that the issue is informed consent, free will, and self-determination, and that's hopefully the message we're going to hear a lot about tonight. I would invite you to read the inserts, not what the pharmacist tells you when you walk up and ask, well, tell me about this vaccine, because they have a little summary that says, oh, this is great, this is wonderful, and it's been proven effective and safe. No, the insert, that's about the font of like 2, you have to use a magnifying glass to read it, and that's what you want to look at. You have to ask them. By law, they're supposed to give that to you. It may be hard, but you need to do that, no matter what vaccine you're talking about. Do your own research. Go to websites like vaxtruth.org or nvic.org. Even the CDC website has information hiding in plain sight, and then you can make your own decision. Then stand up and protect the rights of others to make their own decision, too. That's what we're talking about tonight. That's all we ask. We'd like to recognize and thank Kristen Chevrier, who contacted Dr. Wakefield and was able to facilitate this meeting tonight and bring in both of our speakers, actually. The format tonight, first we'll hear from Dr. Brian Tarbett, then we'll hear from Dr. Andrew Wakefield. After Dr. Wakefield speaks, we'll open it up to questions. However, because of the size of the group and everything else, we're going to ask you to write the questions down. There's a jar on the stool here in the middle. There's also some things you can write your questions down on the side. All questions are valid and available. We just don't have the time. We don't have the microphones to go back and forth. So feel free to write them down. Feel free to get up during the presentation and write your questions down. We're fine with that, too. Okay, they're telling me I got just a few seconds left. So our first speaker, Dr. Brian Tarbett, earned his Ph.D. In organic, and I'm being reminded now that the reason we're ask you to not do any video recording tonight is the following. It is being video recorded. It will be on YouTube eventually. However, some of the stuff that's in the presentation tonight that Dr. Wakefield will be showing you is part of a documentary that will be at the Sundance Film Festival this next go-round, I think January or whenever it is. And if somehow your video was to end up online or show it to somebody or whatever, his documentary could be disqualified. Otherwise, we wouldn't normally care. This is being audio recorded. Hopefully, it'll be on LatterdayConservative.com by the end of the week, but because it's not video, it's audio. Okay, good enough? Okay. Dr. Brian Tarbett earned his Ph.D. in organic chemistry with a minor in biochemistry from Brigham Young University in 1987. As a chemist, Dr. Tarbett has developed and marketed a variety of products and he has over 40 U.S. patents issued or pending and more than 20 publications in peer-reviewed journals. Please welcome Dr. Brian Tarbett.
Thank you. You can either hold it or put it in that thing there. Take it.
Okay, fair warning. One of the reasons that we're having you put the questions in the jars is because you're going to feel like you're drinking from a fire hose. You are not going to get it all in one pass. You're just not. So, let's get started. Your time is valuable. Let's start in with the questions. The whole point of this presentation is to help you ask questions and at least give you some hints as to where to find answers. So this is not designed to be anti-vaccine. This is designed to help you ask good questions and look for good answers that you think can be reliable. So if you look at this chart, you are all familiar with the scientific method. The scientific method helps us discover through iterations what is going on. So if somebody tells you the science is settled, laugh. Just like that. It's never settled. We are always learning. So the whole point of the scientific method is to apply some rules to what you can see and what you can observe so that you can get closer to the truth each time. So that is the whole point of the scientific method. And we are going to go fast because I want to leave plenty of time for Dr. Wakefield. Statistics. So all of you have heard that there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. That's because statistics are easy to manipulate. From the same set of data, depending on what you choose to present, you can give dramatically different outcomes. So one of the things that you need to realize about statistics is when someone does a study, you need to know what question did they ask. Because the question that they ask quite often defines the kind of answers you will get. And so from there, you need to know, did they give you the data or did they just give you charts and graphs? If all they gave you were charts and graphs and no access to the original study, red flag. That's not a good start. Now, it's a pain in the neck to sift through those data. You're out of luck. If you want to know what they did and how they did it, you're going to have to spend the time. So that's point number two or three or four, is if you are really interested, you're going to have to do a lot of this yourself. When we make a presentation, we are trying to give you as much information as we can, but you shouldn't believe me more than you should believe anyone else. Do your homework. I hope I can help you with that. Do your homework. So, as an example, we're going to talk about vaccines. Most of the stuff that I'm going to present in the next 10 minutes is questions, or are questions that are related to the safety and efficacy of vaccines. Questions that I still have that have not got good answers yet. So in your mind, I want you to answer this question. How high do we set the standard for safety and efficacy before we force our neighbors to do what we think is best? How long are you going to do that? How are you going to force someone? Well, you better be awfully darn close to 100%. Because I'm going to be unhappy if you're not. Okay, this is what I believe vaccine safety means in very general terms. There is a database, and it is a government database, and it is all about adverse event reporting. There are a whole pile of listings every single year, people who've been affected by vaccines. At the end of this presentation, I'm going to put up a slide. I want you all to get out your cell phones and take a picture, because it's going to have some contact information. It's going to have, we want to get your emails, and this will be a one way to do it, because you can send emails to Kristen, and we have, this is one of the things. I pulled down the government report for 2014, and you can have it if you want. You can look through it yourself. It's not hard to find, but we've already pulled it down. It's an Excel spreadsheet. It is completely voluntary for the doctors to report this. So it is way underreported because it's voluntary. So there were 40,757 people affected to a greater or lesser extent by vaccines that were reported in 2014. If you're one of those 40,000 people, that can be serious. So these events range from pretty mild, a little bit of a fever for a day, to death. I don't think most of us want children or anyone of any other age to die. Okay, so this is a really general list of what's in a vaccine. I think most of you understand the idea of a vaccine. To give you a dose of a foreign protein that came from an organism that might make you sick that's been killed. So hopefully it doesn't make you sick, but you can still develop an immune response. This is a big word for what is in the vaccine to help it do what it's supposed to do. Adjuvants are interesting because they are supposed to enhance the immune response. It is more long-lived, and it will give you longer protection in theory. Look at that list. So you know that my minor was in biochemistry. I will tell you I am not impressed with that list of adjuvants that are in there along with the organism. Aluminum? Yeah, not so good. Formaldehyde, cells from other species. Thimerosal, which contains mercury. Now, a lot of the vaccines have been changing over the years, so some of these things have been removed. But aluminum is still frequently used because they have not found a good substitute. But aluminum can wind up in the pineal gland. That's right next door to the brain. Not so good, in my opinion. Okay, that was a general statement. These are the excipients found in this vaccine last year. Again, not a fantastic list. If you look through that, some of it you all know. Neomycin sulfate, antibiotic, no big deal. Polymyxin B, again, antibiotic, no big deal. But look at the rest of that list. Modified Latham medium. I'll bet there is only one person in this room who knows what that is. Okay, that is a concoction of a whole bunch of things. So in this list, there's another list. So you need to go look up what that is if you're going to understand what this vaccine might do to you. And it's not the vaccine, it's the rest of the stuff that's in the vaccine along with the organism. So, as far as effectiveness goes, I went and pulled this from the Federal Register, volume number 49, number 107, June 1st, 1984. For those of you who have read that book, that's an interesting year. And it's page number 23,007. I have a problem with this. However, although the continued availability of the vaccine may not be immediately in immediate jeopardy, any possible doubts, whether or not well-founded, about the vaccine cannot be allowed to exist. I miss safety. I don't think I need somebody else deciding what I can and can't do. So if the government, who is in charge of regulating and accepting safety procedures from the pharmaceutical companies, has this opinion, I have questions. This is one of the documents that we can provide you if you give us an email. Send us an email. We have an enormous packet of information. You're welcome to have all of it. You're welcome to have part of it. Whatever you have time to read. This is an interesting slide because it talks about the measles. And you can see where the measles vaccine was introduced. The conclusion in this book, and this is a readily available book, you can buy it hard copy, you can buy a soft copy for your electronic devices, and what you can see is that the bulk of disease seems to be much more related to safe drinking water, sanitation, and food. Healthy food became available in larger and larger quantities, along with the sanitation and clean water. Oh, wait, just about 1940. So those factors have had a much larger influence than the vaccines. Do the vaccines do nothing? I don't think that that's a true statement. Are they the bulk of the reason that disease has been reduced? I don't believe that either. I think that healthy lifestyle practices give us more protection than almost anything else. So here's a question that I have. Why is China having measles outbreaks when 99% are vaccinated? So if the vaccines rise to the level of efficacy that we all expect them to, China has one of the most compliant populations on the planet. You can either do what the government asks you to do, or they'll shoot you. And you might laugh, but I was over there a couple of years ago. It hasn't changed much. They are very compliant, and they are trained to be that way from the start. 99% vaccination rates, and they're still having significant outbreaks. Now, the pharmaceutical companies have started to recommend shorter and shorter times between booster shots. That seems to suggest that the vaccines are not as effective as they once claimed. So when I was growing up, I had the MMR shot. I had the DPT shot. Guess what? I had chickenpox, I had measles, I had mumps. So where do you think I got my immunity from? I got my immunity from the disease. Okay, so scientific method. Are any of you satisfied with that title? I don't want to present this as only from one point of view. Are any of you satisfied with that title, even though you might agree with the sentiment? You shouldn't be. There is no such thing as without doubt. That is a religious statement, not a scientific statement. So when you see statements like that, you should question. So even though the data that they have are very strong, the title is awful. So here is the short list. First, if you are trying to find out whether or not you believe a particular study, who paid for it? Is the person presenting the information making money, or did they lose their job because they presented the information that you got? Guess what? What happened to Galileo? What happened to Copernicus? The history of science is not one of rapid adoption of true principles. So follow the money. If you see the study was paid for by the people producing the vaccine, maybe it's okay, maybe it's not. But right there, I lean towards not. That's a black mark in my book, because in all of the years that I wrote grant proposals and tried to get money for BYU, because that's one of the things you have to do as a graduate student, is you have to write grant proposals, then that money comes into the university. Well, they like that. So who funds the study is the one who gets to ask the questions. And if you don't get the answer they want, your chances of getting another grant are really small. Do you think that skews the process? I do. Statistics, which we've talked about. Details. 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 If you can't get details from the people presenting, if there are just broad, sweeping statements about how good or how bad, or, you know, you're crazy for believing that. Vaccines have been around for generations. It's all because of vaccines. Sorry. That starts to make me a not believer. Are there easy to find distortions? So I read an article about a week ago where the people who are strongly in favor of vaccines said, oh, the pharmaceuticals make money? Pharmaceutical companies make money? Of course they make money. You know what? I'm in favor of them making money. I believe in the system, if it is true free capitalism, to let people compete. However, what you will find is that they said, oh, pharmaceutical companies only make 2%. I went and looked at Merck, because I didn't believe that statement. So I looked up Merck's annual statement, and in their annual statement, they said that their revenue from vaccines was in the neighborhood of $5.5 billion. Now, their total annual revenue from their stock statement said that they make about $44 billion. Well, that's more like 12%. So immediately, I have a reason not to believe the people who say, oh, ignore that, they only make a little money. I don't care if they make money, but don't tell me it's 2% if it's 12%. That causes me serious doubt. References. So we are inviting you to give us an email so that we can give you information as much as you can handle. There are hundreds of pages. You're welcome to read it all. Make sure that you can go to a primary source, because that matters. I want you to take a picture of this one, because this has Kristen's email address on it. Take a picture, write it down. If you send us an email, then we can send you whatever you want from us. We've got this huge stack of stuff, and we've got a whole presentation on statistics that you're welcome to look through. We've got a whole presentation on a bunch of different topics, and we're good to go. Thank you.
For those of you who can't see the email, it's politicalmommy@gmail.com. politicalmommy@gmail.com. Dr. Tarbert mentioned follow the money. Share with you a quick quote. In May of 2005, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in an interview said, quote, I ate breakfast last week with the president of a network news division, and he told me that during the non-election years, 70% of the advertising revenue for his news division comes from pharmaceutical ads. And if you go to the TV any night and watch the network news, you'll see they become just a vehicle for selling pharmaceuticals. He told me that he would fire a host who brought onto his station a guest who lost him a pharmaceutical account, unquote. So, not that I love Robert F. Kennedy either, don't get me wrong, but you know, even a broken clock is right twice a day. So even liars can be right twice a day, right, or whatever. Or not saying he's a liar, but whatever. Okay, how many of you have heard of the controlled media? Anybody ever heard of that term before? Did you know that all the media in the United States is effectively controlled, collectively controlled by six corporations? These six corporations are Time Warner, Walt Disney, Viacom, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, CBS Corporation, and NBC Universal. Together, they absolutely dominate the news and entertainment in the United States. So, once again, I'd ask you, seek for and pray for discernment on this important issue that we're talking about tonight, as well as all the other issues that are pushed upon you on a daily basis. Because the odds are you're being chumped, and we're all being chumped. May God help us awake to our awful situation. We'll now have the privilege of hearing from our keynote speaker, Dr. Andrew Wakefield, whom we're honored to have with us tonight. Dr. Andrew Wakefield, MBBS, is an academic gastroenterologist. He received his medical degree from St. Mary's Hospital Medical School, the University of London, in 1981. He pursued a career in gastrointestinal surgery with a particular interest in inflammatory bowel disease. He's published over 140 original scientific articles, book chapters, and invited scientific commentaries. Contrary to what you'll hear from the mainstream media, Dr. Wakefield is not anti-vaccine. He's pro-safety, pro-informed consent, and Dr. Wakefield's original 250-page controversial study 15 years ago or 16 years ago opposing the use of the combined 3-in-1 MMR is backed up by at least 28 additional studies from medical professionals worldwide that, by the way, are not on big pharma payroll or grants. In pursuit of possible links between childhood vaccines, intestinal inflammation, and neurology injury in children, Dr. Wakefield lost his job, his career, his fellowships, his medical license. He sacrificed it all on the altar of truth. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Andrew Wakefield.
Wow, well, it's a huge pleasure to be here. Thank you very much indeed. This is really it's an extraordinary time in this nation. You will know about SB 277, the passage of mandatory vaccination law in the state of California, that you will be segregated from public and private education if you do not have your children fully vaccinated according to the CDC schedule. And the CDC schedule is something that we're going to discuss tonight, and the talk that you just heard was an excellent introduction to the issues on which these laws must be fought, and that is on safety and efficacy. And it's been said that I am not anti-vaccine. What I am anti, for reasons that will become extremely clear, I am anti-vaccine regulators, and I am anti the pharmaceutical industry. The notion of protecting children against serious infectious disease with safe and effective vaccines is a laudable one. However, the more research that I've done, the more I've come to realize that none of the vaccines on the schedule meet any of those criteria. So, I want to talk about whistleblowing in the public interest, about how to take a moderately successful career and flush it down the toilet. You've heard about the growth in autism. Autism is a new disease. Before the 1930s, we can assume that the prevalence, the incidence of autism in the world was zero. It is a novel condition. The best diagnosticians in medicine, the most astute clinicians, the people who described the great human diseases were not even of the last century. They were of the century before. They were people like Charcot in Paris and Pierre-Marie working for him, who described some of the great diseases. They could do very little for them, but they could describe them in meticulous clinical detail and had a condition as enigmatic as autism existed, it would have been described by those doctors, and yet it was not. It was not until Leo Kanner described it many years later that it first became apparent. But it was rare. It was an anomaly. Physicians, clinicians could expect to see no cases in their lifetime, and then something changed. So we have data now going back to the 70s, and we know that the numbers were 1 in 10,000 very early on, and then it has risen in an exponential fashion. These are numbers from the CDC, so I suggest you treat them with some caution. You can see now that the rise has approached 1 in 68. This is for children who were born in 2002. So these data are many years out of date. The CDC is mandated to provide these data every 4 years. They have not provided them. And that means, I suggest to you, that the news is not good. The risk for autism, if you extrapolate from this curve, the risk for autism for a child born today in America is 1 in 25. 1 in 25 children. And if you take this line, as an MIT scientist has done, and you extrapolate it out as a, if you log this line, you can tell, looking into the future, where it will intersect with 1 in 2. Sorry, let me go back. And that is in the year, according to her, of 2032. She has reason to believe, and has said publicly, as you've heard earlier, that it will happen earlier, perhaps by 2025. When 1 in 2 of the population has autism, you either have it or you care for someone with it. And that's it. You have no standing army, no economy, no infrastructure whatsoever. And that is the way this is headed. And there is absolutely no reason to believe that the trajectory of this curve is going to change whatsoever. None. And the absence of the latest CDC data gives us cause for concern. This is what is happening. This is the most important issue in America today. Forget foreign policy, forget everything else. If this is going to continue, there is no economy, there is no foreign policy. And the irony is that even without a standing army, nobody is going to want to invade this country, because it is a country of damaged people. Please think about that. If you love this country and you wish only the best for its future, something has to be done to change this. And autism, medicine gives you the sharp end first. It gives you the worst cases, the most easily recognized cases first. What happens if what we are doing to damage children causing autism is shaving 9 points or 5 points off the IQ of the average American? We know now that the SAT scores have had to be recentered twice in the last decade to get the same pass rate. Boys in particular are failing in schools, not girls. This is a biological phenomenon. It is not a problem with the school infrastructure. This is a biological phenomenon. And we saw it before with lead poisoning, we saw this sex-specific difference, and we're seeing it again now for autism and IQ problems. And this problem is worldwide. This is a paper from the Environmental Protection Agency, and it looks at the incidence of autism worldwide. That is the number of new cases occurring year on year, plotted by year of birth. And what is extraordinary about this is that there is a common denominator, a factor or a set of constrained factors that operated at the same time in different countries around the world. Denmark, Japan, and the US, shown in here, and in the bottom graph, the trajectory for the worldwide aggregated incidence data. It happened, the hockey stick effect occurred in children born in 1988 and 89. It is as discrete as that. Something changed in those birth cohorts that led to this dramatic increase. And the conclusion is that there is some common denominator between these countries, and that must help us to pin it down. This must be environmental. You do not have genetic epidemics. This is definitely environmental. It can be understood. And by looking at what those common denominators might be, we can start to hone in on the cause. Now, this is my introduction to this. I'm a gastroenterologist. When I was at medical school, autism was so rare we were not taught about it. On May the 19th, 1995, a mother called me, a very articulate mother, a very clever woman, who said, my child was developing perfectly normally. He had speech, language, interaction with his siblings. He was a happy little boy. And then he had his MMR vaccine, his measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. He had a high fever. He slept for 3 days. And when he woke up, he was never the same again. He was then diagnosed with autism. She was not anti-vaccine. She was not looking for something to blame. She was describing precisely what happened to her child. The fundamental rule of clinical medicine is you listen to the patient, or you listen to the patient's parents. Because nobody knows that child like their mother. No pediatrician, no public health doctor. You listen to the mother, and she will tell you what happened to that child. If the child had gone to a party and caught natural chickenpox and had regressed within a week, then as doctors we would be saying, that's a terrible thing, we need to produce a chickenpox vaccine, which of course we now have. But because it was a vaccine that in the mother's eyes was the trigger for this problem, it could not be. It was not to be discussed. She said to me, doctor, my child has terrible gastrointestinal issues, which is why I've come to you. And I believe that those gastrointestinal issues are related to their autism. When the diarrhea is really bad, when he's bloated and he's in pain, and I know he's in pain, because even though he's lost the ability to speak, to articulate his pain, to tell me where it is, and he's banging his head against the wall, I, as his mother, know that he is suffering from pain. And when this is bad, this is bad. And when I treat this, and when I put him on a special diet that excludes gluten or casein or soy, then this gets better. The bowel gets better and the brain gets better. There is some link, doctor. This was an extraordinary intuition that turned out to be absolutely right. And she said, doctor, I know that there are many, many parents who are calling me and telling me exactly the same story. And so we saw 12 of these children, and we published this case series in The Lancet. A case series is where you take a group of patients who have a unique and idiosyncratic pattern of signs and symptoms. They present in such a common way and such a unique way that they merit publication in their own right. You're not testing a hypothesis. You're not saying this is the cause or that's the cause or this is the mechanism. You're saying here is the story. This is what we heard. This is what we found. And these are ideas that we have about this going forward, hypotheses that we might test in the future. And this is the way in which human disease syndromes are described, be it congenital rubella, be it Crohn's disease, be it multiple sclerosis or AIDS, anything you like. This is the way in which the description of human disease syndromes begins. And then a better understanding evolves in an iterative way, as you've heard, from that point forward. This paper was very careful, having explained the findings of the bowel disease, to say in the final paragraph, this study does not prove an association between MMR vaccine and the syndrome described. Further work is needed to investigate this. And yet it has been said in the media worldwide that I have claimed in this paper with my colleagues that MMR vaccine causes autism. Explicitly, that is not what we said. And that's what you've heard, then those people who told you have not bothered to read the paper. What has happened in the intervening years has been a sideshow, a tragedy, to divert attention from gross regulatory failure to protect individuals, to protect governments, but fundamentally to protect the industry from past liabilities and future profits, and I intend to discuss that tonight. And it came down in the end to Rupert Murdoch and his son, James Murdoch, who was on the board of GlaxoSmithKline, which was the UK's MMR vaccine manufacturer, he was put on, James Murdoch was put on that board to protect GlaxoSmithKline's reputation in News International Media, and I was his favorite target. And Brian Deer, the journalist working for the Sunday Times, owned by Murdoch, published a paper which claimed all kinds of things, that this paper, that what we had done was experimentation on children, there was no ethical approval, it was all done to foment a legal case, it was done to make money, all kinds of things, a huge, complex study. And this is John Walker Smith. John Walker Smith was the world's leading pediatric gastroenterologist at the time, before his retirement. He wrote the textbook that teaches now pediatric gastroenterologists around the world. He was one of the founding fathers of the subject of pediatric gastroenterology. And he said there was a bowel disease, and he investigated these children, and his team discovered that bowel disease along with me, and it was his word pitted against that of Brian Deer, of a man with no scientific and no medical training. And the General Medical Council decided that they would side with Brian Deer and believe him. Well, this finally came, and you will never have heard of this. We were struck off, we had our licenses removed, and for the first time, when Professor Walker Smith appealed to the English High Court, this was the first time it had ever come before a proper judiciary, then in his appeal, the judge said of the General Medical Council that they had made fundamental errors. There was a distortion of evidence, inadequate analysis, inadequate and superficial reasoning and explanation, inappropriate rejection of evidence, flawed and wrong reasoning, and numerous and significant inadequacies. Universal inadequacies, excuse me, this may look like water. It is in fact moonshine. But don't tell anyone. Universal inadequacies and some errors on the panel's determination accordingly go to the heart of this case. They are not curable. The panel's determination cannot stand. I therefore quash it. In other words, everything that Brian Deer had said went out the window. Everything that News International said had gone out the window. Did this appear in the media? Did the exoneration of Professor Walker Smith and that study appear in the media? Did they reinstate the study in The Lancet? No. Because the fix was in from the beginning. This is Brian Deer. It was later the case that the Brian Deer in the British Medical Journal accused me of scientific fraud, that it was all made up. There were 13 scientists on that paper, including some of the world's leading pediatric gastroenterologists. Unimpeachable careers. We published 5,000 papers between us. Do you think it likely that I could get away with publishing a paper that pulled the wool over all of the eyes of all of these scientists? Really? But that's the lie they bought into. And this is Brian Deer. When Brian Deer, we sued Brian Deer in the court in Travis County, Texas, where I live. And we were denied jurisdiction, ultimately. Even in the face of precedent, we were denied jurisdiction, which is a great shame because in discovery, this is the kind of thing that we found in emails between Brian Deer and the editor of the BMJ. This is the kind of objectivity that the editor of the BMJ was looking for in her writers, Deer on himself. I freely admit to being semi-notorious for packing into single, highly readable and apparently bland sentences rat's nests of complexity and implication. This is the man upon whom science and medicine have placed their trust. Deer on the parents, if you ever thought that he operated out of altruism, out of concern for autism parents, this is what he said on his website. The festering nastiness, the creepy repetitiveness, the weaselly deceitful obsessiveness, all signal pathology to me, and they wonder why their children have problems with their brains. That is Brian Deer. They are welcome to him. So, this is the kind of child that we saw at the Royal Free. By the time I'd left, we'd seen about 180 such children and made a huge advance in understanding what was going on and helping them. This child looks like a famine victim from West Africa. You can see in profile that his abdomen is grossly distended. He has no muscle mass. He is clearly extremely physically unwell. Who is the person who is under investigation in this family? The mother. The mother by CPS and doctors for starving her child, and yet behind him is his sister, who belies that notion because she is perfectly well nourished. This child had inflammatory bowel disease. This child, it was said, he would do this, he would lean on pieces of furniture for hours a day. Hours a day. Oh, this is just repetitive behavior. This is just autism. No, it is not. This child is applying pressure to his abdomen to relieve the pain that he cannot articulate because he's lost the power to speak. He is doing something that is entirely appropriate to relieve that pain. This little boy would sleep like this. He would sleep on this ball with his head on his little doggy because he was in pain. And we know that because when he was treated, when his inflammatory bowel disease was treated, he stopped doing this. He went to bed and he slept normally. This is self-injury. This little boy was in such pain that he would beat himself unconscious in order to alleviate that pain, to escape from it. This little boy came to see us in Texas to be investigated, to be scoped. And the parents were in such distress, they had to stop in the car halfway in an emergency room. And can you imagine taking this little boy into an emergency room and what might happen? Their only salvation is that the doctor in the ER had an autistic child himself and recognized what was going on immediately, helped the child and sent him on his way. This little boy is trying to kill himself. This child is in such pain that he is trying to end his life. This is self-injury. This is what I see on a daily basis. So when someone tells me that autism is great and we should accept it, it's just part of being normal, this is what we deal with on a daily basis. And the irony of this, we are surrounded by ironies, is that the father of this child is a senior executive in the company Wyeth that produces thimerosal, the mercury preservative in vaccines. Data from other scientists, and this is now the most common and consistent finding in autism research today, is the gastrointestinal link, the disturbance between the gut and the brain. Our data clearly show that gastrointestinal problems are very common in children with autism. Why are they in pain? This is an image taken through a pill cam. So you swallow the capsule, it goes through your small intestine, takes 2 frames a second, and this shows inflammation and ulceration similar to what you might see in Crohn's disease. That picture does not come from us. That comes from Dr. Balzola in Turin in Italy, who has described in the medical literature exactly the same bowel disease. This is an image of duodenal ulceration. This is an extremely sick duodenum, which would have you and I screaming in pain on the floor in a patient with autism. And this comes from Japan. This is a worldwide phenomenon. And these are the papers that were published in addition to the Lancet paper before I left the Royal Free. We had described this disease and characterized it in some detail. There is this enigmatic link between the gut and the brain. And the chief medical officer, who's the equivalent of the Surgeon General, said to me, "I just don't get this gut-brain thing you're talking about." And I said, "Well, look, come with me and I'll buy you a beer. And within 15 minutes, you'll understand what I'm talking about." And this idiot thought that I wanted to buy him a beer. I can't stand the man. What I was trying to get across to him is that a neurotoxin from the gut can affect the brain, even his brain. And the important thing about this is that the parents were right. There is a link between the bowel and the brain. It was real and it was common and it was treatable. But because of the lies told by Brian Deer, the medical profession was terrified of doing its job. And for the intervening years, these children could not get appropriate medical care because the bowel disease was synonymous with vaccine injury and nobody wanted to touch it. So autism remained a psychological thing that was in the brain. It was genetic and that was it. Put your child in a home and get over it. So they were right about the bowel disease. Were they right about the vaccine? I don't know, but we had to take that extremely seriously. I certainly didn't know at the time. We had an obligation, a duty to take that seriously, not to dismiss it because it might be uncomfortable. And all of this may have gone nowhere. All of this may have gone absolutely nowhere because of the power of the industry, its influence on politicians, its influence on the media, which has been bought by that industry. If not for one man. If not for one man. Last year, 2014, time goes very, very quick. Dr. William Thompson, a senior scientist from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, came forward to a colleague and friend of mine, Dr. Brian Hooker, who's the father of an affected child living in Redding, California, and a scientist. They had been at odds for some time because Dr. Hooker had been seeking through FOIA requests to get access to vaccine safety data from the CDC and had got into various fights with the scientist who'd been designated to look after him or to deal with him, and that was Dr. Thompson. So it was unusual, to say the least, that 10 years later he should call him out of the blue. But call him he did. And the history of this is that in 2000, I presented to Congress, to the government's oversight committee. Dan Burton held a series of hearings. Dan Burton was a congressman from Indiana whose grandson was vaccine damaged and autistic. And I presented to that committee and I presented these findings and I talked about the circumstances in which a child might be damaged. And I'll move to this. Why some children and not others? One of the questions that we hear a lot is, MMR is given to everybody. Why should some children have problems and not others? And one of the things that we were interested in is pattern of exposure. The way in which you're infected with a particular virus determines the outcome. The age of exposure is critical. If you get measles under one, you're much more likely to have an adverse outcome than if you get it over one. This is intuitive. The immune system's developed, you're stronger. And so we put forward the hypothesis to Congress and to the CDC that age of exposure to MMR may be a risk. The younger a child gets the vaccine, the greater the risk. And there was a reason for believing that. And there is an MMR vaccine that was produced by GlaxoSmithKline used in the UK. It wasn't used here. And there was a mumps strain in it called Urabi AM9. It came from Japan and it caused meningitis. Interestingly, when used alone as the single monovalent mumps vaccine, it didn't cause meningitis. When it was put in MMR, it caused meningitis at a rate of more than 1 in 2,000. There's a fascinating observation right off the bat. 1 and 1 and 1 doesn't equal 3, equals something very different. And this meningitis from the mumps vaccine was recognized in Ontario, where they'd introduced it, and they withdrew it rapidly. But the British government wanted that vaccine used in the UK because it was made by the home team, GlaxoSmithKline. And they wanted to give them 85% of the market. So they brought in a doctor, a whistleblower, who came to me later from the government in Canada to advise them in the introduction of that vaccine in the UK. He said, don't touch it. It's causing meningitis at an unacceptable rate. They ignored him completely. The only thing that changed was the name. It was called Trivirix in Canada, and they changed the name to Pluserix in the UK. And they introduced it. Glaxo got SmithKline-Beecham at the time got 85% of the market. 4 years later, after meningitis occurred in exactly the same way, it had to be rapidly withdrawn, and we went to Merck to get the MMR2. At that point, the vaccine should have been destroyed. It's now been withdrawn in two countries. It should have been destroyed, but was it? No. It was shipped to developing countries like Brazil, where it was used in a mass vaccination campaign. And not surprisingly, there was an epidemic of meningitis. These are the people you are dealing with. Please understand, there is absolutely no concern for the downside for children whatsoever. And when they studied that epidemic in Brazil, what they found is that those at greatest risk were the ones who got the vaccine youngest. So there you have it again. The younger the exposure, the greater the risk. And another drug that shows this really exquisitely well was thalidomide. You didn't use thalidomide in America, but it was a drug taken for morning sickness. It was developed in Germany and then used in countries around the world, not America. It was one of the great successes of the FDA, was keeping this drug out of this country. It was used as morning sickness, and children were born like this, with no arms, no legs, blind, deaf, no ears. This is phocomelia. And the important thing about this is that the timing at which the mother took the drug during pregnancy was absolutely critical. And interesting, this drug taken by the mother during pregnancy was associated with autism. But she had to take the drug between 20 and 24 days. That is how narrow a window in which this drug operated to cause autism. And children with autism had ear abnormalities because the ear was developing at the same time. They did not have limb abnormalities. It was all about timing. And so we gave the hypothesis to the CDC that we believe younger age of MMR vaccination with autism is a risk for autism. And that's exactly what they went away and tested, and that's exactly what they found. And that is exactly what they hid from the American public for 13 years. They found the autism risk in two groups of children who were at exquisitely high risk: African-American boys and children with what they called isolated autism, who were developmentally normal for the first year of life, irrespective of race, and that is a whole lot of children. And the most worrying thing about these two groups is the greatest risk was seen in those children receiving their vaccine on schedule, between 12 and 18 months. And Thompson, on this study, was the accountant in a money laundering ring. He was the statistician. He was the guy with the data, the skills, and the software. And he went to the meeting and he showed them what they had. And they spent the intervening 4 years manipulating and covering up those data. In the end, they found they could not get rid of them altogether, so they destroyed the data. They destroyed it. They moved from a level of a scientific fraud with huge consequences for the American population and by proxy the rest of the world, to a felony by destroying government documents, which were at the time under FOIA request and Department of Justice request. So, let me go back. Dr. Thompson, unlike the others, was a man of conscience. He was a man of conscience, and he was deeply troubled by what was going on. And we have all of the original documents provided to us by him, all of the original data sets, the analyses, the internal emails, the exchanges between him and Julie Gerberding, who was head of the CDC at the time, the head of the National Immunization Program, Dr. Walter Orenstein. He alerted them all to this problem. What was happening in 2004, there was a meeting of the Institute of Medicine where they had to present an update on their findings. They delayed them. They had the data at the end of 2001. They should have presented them to Congress in 2002 and 2003. They didn't. They held on to them, and they manipulated them further. They had to present them in 2004, and Dr. Thompson was carded to do that presentation. And his conscience was so troubled that he wrote to Julie Gerberding, and he said, "I will have to present data showing an association between MMR vaccine and autism." And he wrote to Walter Orenstein, making it absolutely clear to him that there was this link, these troubling data. Data are data. They shouldn't be troubling, that they are unable to get rid of. And 3 days before the Institute of Medicine meeting, then he was removed from the roster because he said he would have to present the facts. Dr. Frank DiStefano of the National Immunization Program took the stand and lied. He hid the data completely. The Institute of Medicine wrote a report declaring that MMR vaccine was safe. They went further and said that all research into this association should now stop should not be funded further. It went even further than that, and the courts, the vaccine court, where there were 5,000 children as plaintiffs waiting to have their cases heard, were thrown out based upon that IOM report saying that MMR vaccine was not associated with autism, and they were denied justice for all time. The vaccine went on being given in 1, 2, 3 doses earlier in life. Children were being put at risk. Millions and millions of American children were deliberately and knowingly, recklessly put in harm's way in order to protect what? In order to protect what? Why? They had the opportunity to just change the age at which the vaccine was given. It wasn't anti-vaccine. They could simply have given the vaccine after 3, the group they compared them with, and found that the risk of autism was much less. One thing they should not do and cannot do is mandate that parents have to expose their children to this risk in the face of this obvious federal fraud. That is absolutely unacceptable. And when the bill comes around again here, as it will, for you to mandate that your children get this MMR, there can be no mandates. There can be no mandates where there is risk, particularly in the face of such an extraordinary fraud. This is the greatest medical fraud in the history of the world. Let me characterize it. It's not as though we're dealing with patients with end-stage terminal cancer who are receiving a drug where the data get bloated in favor of the pharmaceutical industry. You are dealing with healthy infants, every healthy infant in the country. You're dealing with the future of the country. You are destroying the future of the country, willfully and deliberately. What does it prove? It proves once again that the parents were right. That's what it proves. Does MMR cause all autism? No. But for those parents who came forward and said, this is what happened, they were right. And medicine needs to have the humility to go back to its origins, back to its roots, and listen. And listen. So, Senator Pan forced through the bill in the certain knowledge that this fraud had taken place in California. I know that because I provided him with all the information. And that deals with the issue of safety. Dr. Thompson has said himself that the CDC can no longer be trusted to do vaccine safety studies. Just while talking about Dr. Thompson and what one should do in going forward, I just want to read to you, if I could find my glasses, which I can't. Oh, there, can't even see. Can't see them to put them on. That's a terrible thing. This is what he said, and I want to ask you, as your opinion is that this has to come before Congress. This is a federal crime. It must come before Congress. It must come before the Oversight Committee on Government Reform. That is the appropriate place. And your congressman here, Chavitz, is in charge of that committee. And he must hear this case. He must get Dr. Thompson in front of him. Dr. Thompson is willing to testify under oath to that committee. But that must happen. It cannot be allowed that the pharmaceutical industry can lobby and buy and put pressure on politicians to the extent that they do not do their job. It cannot be the case that the public health authorities say to that committee, no, we can investigate this ourselves, which is exactly what the CDC has said in response to an official complaint that I sent to them. We can investigate this. I can already tell you that that is a whitewash. It is an absolute whitewash. And that is what will happen. Nothing will come out of this. It will be business as usual. This is what he wrote. Okay, I'd really like to start by outlining where the three of us have common ground. That's me, Dr. Thompson, and Dr. Hooker. I was involved in deceiving millions of taxpayers regarding the potential negative side effects of vaccines. That's it, right there. That's it. That is every reason why he must come before that committee. This is a federal crime. The mantra should be that the CDC once again, note that, once again didn't share controversial analysis and results, and the CDC can no longer be trusted to do vaccine safety work. The CDC can't be trusted to be transparent and monitor vaccine adverse events. Just a few thoughts. What about the efficacy of the vaccine? Let's just take that same vaccine, MMR, and talk about the efficacy. That is the ability of the vaccine to prevent disease. We've pulled one plank from under the case for mandatory vaccination, safety. Now let's deal with efficacy. Merck, some 10 years ago, another whistleblower came to me in Chicago and handed me a bunch of documents that had been secured from the Merck vaccine, MMR vaccine laboratories. And these documents showed clear evidence of fraud. What had happened is that the mumps vaccine in the MMR was not working, and there were outbreaks of mumps around the country, around the world, in highly vaccinated populations. So you had college students and older adults getting mumps after having two or three doses of the mumps vaccine. Now, why is that important? The vaccine wasn't working. Mumps in children is trivial. Mumps in adults is not trivial. In postpubertal males in particular, it can cause testicular inflammation and sterility. So a mumps vaccine that does not work turns a harmless disease into a serious disease. Exactly the same has happened with chickenpox. Let me move through some slides here, which I want to. They were told that they would lose their license. The FDA said, if you cannot prove that what you say on your product insert, 96% efficacy, then you will lose your license. And they knew they couldn't do that. Now, Merck had two options. You see, if you lose the license for mumps, you lose the license for MMR, in which this country they have a monopoly. It throws the marketplace wide open. They really, really don't want that. So they had two choices. They can improve the vaccine in the interests of children, or they can fix the results in the interests of Merck. Which do you think they chose to do? Yes. So the first thing they did is to say, it doesn't work, our test doesn't work. The test in the laboratory was called plaque reduction neutralization, PRN. It doesn't really matter about the details, but this is the way in which they assessed the potency of the vaccine, its ability to neutralize the virus. It didn't work against the wild virus, the wild mumps virus, that you were worried about, so they got away with using it against the weakened vaccine virus. You're not interested in that. You're interested in protection against the natural infection. But the vaccine didn't work for that, so they got away with looking at the weakened vaccine virus, and it still didn't work. It couldn't even neutralize the weakened vaccine virus. So then they had a brilliant idea. They would develop a test that allowed the detection of 95% efficacy, that allowed it. What do you think? Does anyone in this room know what Merck did in their laboratory to produce that test that allowed it? They added rabbit's blood. They added rabbit's blood to the test. What has that got to do with protection of children against mumps? Nothing. It's a completely non-specific artifactual effect that gave them the result they wanted, except that it didn't. And here's why. Because when you look at the efficacy of a vaccine, you take 100 children who've never been exposed to mumps or the vaccine, you take their blood, you then give them the vaccine, and 6 weeks later you take another blood sample and you show that there are no antibodies here and there are antibodies here, and you've protected them. And the problem with the rabbit's blood is that it made these blood samples positive. So they went from positive to positive. Well, big deal, that doesn't show efficacy. And at that stage, they got the scientists into the laboratory and they just said, we want you to cross out the offending results that we don't want and change them. And Steve Carlin, who was the scientist who became the whistleblower, just said, no, that is fraud and I'm not doing it. And in fact, I'm going to report you to the FDA. Brave guy. So they said, right, well, you'll go to prison. So he went to see his boss, and then he went to see his boss's boss, a guy called Emilio Amini, who tried to explain to him that this was a business decision. It wasn't about protecting children. This was a business decision. And he said, well, I'm still going to report you to the FDA. He said, well, you'll definitely go to prison. So Carlin went, and he got on his phone, and he reported them to the FDA. He reported a serious violation to the FDA, and the FDA were kind enough to call Merck and say, we're coming to do a surprise visit to your laboratory next week. You can't write this stuff, people. You cannot write this. That is exactly what happened, giving them time to destroy the offending evidence, except that Carlin had already secured it. And that is now in federal court in Pennsylvania. Merck have moved to have the case struck out on the basis that, yes, they committed fraud, but the FDA knew about it. Well, no, they didn't. They knew some of it, they were complicit in some of it, and that's their problem. But the judge said, you are going to trial. So there you have it. Just one vaccine, MMR, is neither safe nor is it efficacious. And it is absolutely unacceptable under those circumstances to even consider the possibility of mandatory vaccine laws. Where there is risk, there must be choice. I was going to show you some of the clips from the movie. I think I probably will, actually, if I can get it back. No, I'm not. It's so difficult to get back up. Let me just see. How long have we got? Have we got any time left?
All night.
We've got all night. Okay. I was going to ask. I came in and I said to my gracious hostess, I said, look, after giving a lecture, I usually have a cold beer. And is that going to offend anyone? yes, no, but no. She said, no, it won't, but we've no idea where we can find it around here. So if anyone could write on one of those cards at the back where I can find a cold beer, I'd be really grateful.
In California, the worst measles outbreak in 15 years is spreading.
The virus is roaring back into the headlines tonight. An outbreak somehow traced to visitors.
Someone who had probably caught measles abroad visited Disneyland and may have sneezed.
We're going to get the latest now on that measles outbreak.
Major outbreak.
A highly contagious measles outbreak.
Measles outbreak.
Measles on the march in America.
The people who got the measles, they just simply weren't vaccinated.
Most of them, exactly.
Recent events,
yeah.
Such as the measles outbreak that began in Disneyland last December, has proved that our community immunity is waning to dangerously low levels.
A bill that would ban exemptions from childhood vaccines is advancing through the California legislature.
We are authoring legislation that will abolish the personal belief exemption.
This outbreak is showing no signs of letting up. There are already more cases this year.
In 2014, the number tripled to 644 measles cases reported in 27 states.
I think you're starting to see why it is that mandates are so important.
And I mean, is this all basically because of the anti-vaccination movement? Because parents aren't vaccinating their kids?
Yeah, you know, I think so.
There has been some inaccurate information circulating about vaccines.
There is no good reason to choose not to get a vaccine.
Mostly stemming from a British study linking vaccines to autism.
We still continue to hear that vaccine caused autism, even though that's been debunked.
Repeatedly and thoroughly debunked.
The people who go and engage in those anti-vaccine efforts, you know, they kill children.
This would all be okay if your kids were the only ones affected. They're your kids, but they're not, because unvaccinated kids put all children in danger.
You may have heard vaccination causes autism in 1 out of 110 children. F*** that. Total bullshit. It doesn't.
So let me be absolutely clear. There is no link between the measles vaccine and autism.
But of course, that's according to doctors, so, you know, take that with a grain of salt.
I would strongly encourage everybody, look at the science, look at the facts. CDC, the Center for Disease Control, can give you good information. Listen to your pediatrician. Get your children vaccinated.
I have waited a long time to tell my story.
and I want to tell it truthfully.
This is a scratch audio track, just me, but this is not me.
I spent 2 years running analyses and analyzing results for the MMR autism study. I was involved in deceiving millions of taxpayers over the potential negative side effect of vaccines. We lied about the scientific findings. The CDC can no longer be trusted to do vaccine safety work. Just a few thoughts. I know more details, but can't share them now.
So that really kind of just opens the documentary and sets the scene for what you're going to hear next. As I say, that was William Thompson, who, not me, but I was doing the voiceover. I just want to show you some of the characters you'll meet in this. How do I move that along? If you can help me, put it on 9:59, if you would.
Developing normally, he was this beautiful boy, and we ended up at our 12-month visit, which is his 1 year. Then they gave him multiple vaccines at once. And in 7 days, he had a 104 fever and a rash all over his body. He had previously been noted in our videos, home videos, that he was walking and actually running at that point. And 7 days after the vaccine, he was no longer able to do that. Falling down, I spoke to the pediatrician's office, and they actually told me that it was consistent with a reaction to Proquad, but that I should not worry. We brought him in to his 15-month well check, and he was due for his DPT, his fourth one, and IPV, and we gave him to him. We were told to, and within 24 hours, he changed. He became a really sick little boy, and he swelled up. His face swelled, and he had 105 fever, I think we got up to at that point. He seemed to just rapidly decline, this time medically, and then he really lost his ability to walk. Any little thing that he gained in that small period of time, those few months from the 12th month to the 15th month, just gone.
One of the commonest questions we get is, why are all children exposed to MMR but only some develop autism? And in order to understand why that...
We walked into the pediatric office. Lou, his twin, she's screaming her head off. I mean, she knows what's going on. She doesn't want the doctor touching her. She doesn't want to be there. I look up, and there she's got the shots lined up. She's got 3 for him, 3 for her. By the second shot, Lucinda had flipped herself over, so I had to stop looking at what I was doing, unstrap her, get her out. Well, the minute I get her out and I calm her down a little bit and I look over, he's screaming. I look at the shots and I notice that one of hers was gone. There are only 2 shots left for her. And I asked the nurse practitioner, I said, what happened to that other shot? She says, oh my goodness. I gave it to him. I said, which one was it? She said, it was the other MMR. I said, call the doctor. This baby is screaming his head off. You're giving him an extra shot. I don't know what the effects of that's going to be. We're leaving. And I left. So she never got her shots. I go home. This baby cried. I put him down on his little blanket. He starts banging his head on the floor. Next morning, I go in his room.
On your face.
And he's staring in the space, and he's looking around like this, as if, you know, he's a bit paralyzed. Not the baby who was always doing this every morning, smiling, for me to get him out of bed. And I pick him up and he does this. And I said, what has happened to my baby? So I call the clinic and I said, I think my child's had adverse reaction to those shots yesterday. She says, no.
In the final publication is that race in general is downplayed.
Of course it is.
At the end of this journey, I don't want to be one of those mothers standing there saying what I wish I would have, could have, should have done. I want to be able to say I gave it everything that I had. I gave it my best shot. And however he ends up, before I leave this world, I want to be able to say I did what I could do for my son. His twin is going into the 11th grade. And for someone who may not even live to see the end of the journey and can't trust that there's going to be someone around to care for him, a child who still can't manage to cross the street. Now, am I grateful he's here? You bet. I'm grateful my son lived. And I was so naive that he would live a fulfilling life. He would end up being a happy man, having meaningful relationships, falling in love, married, having a family. My dreams for him. And every year that goes by, the older my son gets, the further that dream seems to be.
Saying we don't like what we've got, let's move these around, slice and dice until we get something. In the end, they simply couldn't get rid of it, so they left it out of the paper and the presentation altogether.
Never even made it into the paper.
Never made it to the paper.
I was just looking at that. I'm like, oh my God, I cannot believe we did what we did. But we did.
Yeah.
So it's all there. It's all there.
Struck him out. That's one of them.
Pass ball in the outside corner. Swindell strikes out the side.
And he gets the strikeout of Bagwell, his first National League K.
Fastball and foul tip and hill. Well, that's the third strikeout for Greg Swindell.
The highlight of my career, one, was my son being born that year in 2001. And then also going on to win the World Series against the New York Yankees the same year.
The Diamondbacks are world champions!
He was growing. He was off the charts and just about everything, height and weight and everything was there. I mean, he was just a cute little boy. We had no worries about him. I would take him in the locker room with me. He would hang out with the guys. And Haley, his oldest sister's name, he would say her name. And when you say, were you ready to go to the store? And he would say the word store. And so things were starting to develop for him until, I guess he was 13 or 14 months. I went on a road trip. My wife went on a road trip with me. Said bye to him. Her mom was watching him, and he had gotten the shot, the MMR, I believe the day before. And she was only gone 3 days. And by the time she got back, he wasn't paying attention to her. He wouldn't look at her. Her mom said that he had thrown up in his crib for 3 straight days. And from that point on, he just slowly digressed and never said another word. And pretty much, I guess we call it, just kind of checked out. At one point, that during a baseball game, I had one of the team doctors come in the locker room, and we brought Dawson down there, and he looked at him. I mean, the game's going on in the stadium, and we're in the doctor's office, and he set us up with a specialist in Arizona, And we went in, and she told us that he should be institutionalized and he'll never amount to anything. Those are the last words I heard her say. I grabbed him and walked out. I wasn't going to believe it. No.
This is not the first time the CDC...
The chair recognizes the gentleman from Florida, Mr. Posey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In August 2014, Dr. William Thompson, a senior scientist at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, worked with a whistleblower attorney to provide my office with documents related to a 2004 CDC study that examined the possibility of a relationship between mumps, measles, rubella, vaccines, and autism. Mr. Speaker, I respectfully request the following excerpts from the statement written by Dr. Thompson be entered into the record. Now quoting Dr. Thompson. My primary job duties while working in the immunization safety branch from 2000 to 06 were to lead or co-lead three major vaccine safety studies. The MADDSP MMR Autism Cases Control Study was being carried out in response to the Wakefield Lancet study that suggested an association between the MMR vaccine and an autism-like health outcome. We hypothesized that if we found statistically significant effects at either 18 or 36-month thresholds, we would conclude that vaccinating children early with MMR vaccine could lead to autism-like characteristics or features. For the non-birth certificate sample, the adjusted race effect statistical significance was huge. All the authors and I met and decided sometime between August and September 2002 not to report any race effects for the paper. Sometime soon after the meeting, we decided to exclude reporting any race effects. The co-authors scheduled a meeting to destroy documents related to the study. The remaining four co-authors all met and brought a big garbage can into the meeting room and reviewed and went through all the hard copy documents that we had thought we should discard and put them in a huge garbage can. However, because I assumed it was illegal and would violate both FOIA and DOJ requests, I kept hard copies of all documents in my office and I retained all associated computer files. I believe we intentionally withheld controversial findings from the final draft of the pediatrics paper. End of quote of the doctor. Considering the nature of the whistleblower's documents, as well as the involvement of the CDC, a hearing and a thorough investigation is warranted. So I ask, Mr. Speaker, I implore my colleagues on the Appropriations Committees to please, please take such action. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I yield back.
So there you have it. It's the greatest medical fraud in the history of the world conducted against your children. Whether you believe vaccines cause autism or not, you have a moral obligation as a citizen and a parent, not to allow this to stand. This must come before the Oversight Committee. You have the power to make that happen right here in Utah. That is your duty, that is your obligation. It's the future of this country and the future of the world is at stake. What happened to me is utterly irrelevant. It happened. It's just a fact of life. It doesn't matter. It's not important. What is important for the children. What is important is the future. And so I'm looking to you to make a difference, because this cannot succeed when the consumer demands change. The underbelly of all of this requires that you trust in the policymakers. And after this, I do not believe anyone can trust in the CDC. And it's therefore important that you call them to account and that we make change. The vaccine is given later. They're broken up. They're separated out. Vaccines that are not necessary should not be given. They should be spaced longer over time. Vaccine safety research should be completely outside the jurisdiction of the CDC. Their mandate is to make sure that every child in this country gets fully vaccinated. How can they possibly be in charge of vaccine safety at the same time? They cannot. That needs to be put into a completely separate agency. If you have a Boeing plane crashes, you do not have Boeing investigating that crash. And it cannot be the same with vaccines either. So there are very positive things that can be done to change this. But that must happen, and it must happen in the next election. And you must end up voting for the politician who is going to make a difference to this issue, because this is the future of this country. Thank you very much.
Can you do questions and answers?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. We'll take a little break. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Should we? Okay. Once you get these.
Okay, question time. Question time.
Okay, folks, come on.
I just want to say I haven't seen one piece of paper that's told me how to get a cold beer yet, so I'm disappointed.
Does anybody know of a bar here in West Orem where you can go? Yes, ma'am. You're looking it up on Google? Okay, good. I mean,
no, you're a good sport.
He is without sin to cast the first stone, okay, right? There we go. All right, the first question Jeff's going to ask.
Okay, this is coming in from out of state, from a good friend of mine, Lisa. She says this, I've wondered about Kelly. Kelly is her daughter who is in her late 20s right now. Kelly's mental breakdown, severe anxiety, and hallucinations, delusions, when she had the MMR vaccine, she was in a state of severe anxiety and suffered hallucinations for 24 hours. I was told it was the rubella part of the vaccine, and she never had the R part of the shot again, unless it's administered, whatever. She says that she was only 2 years old when she had the vaccine.
Right. It's interesting that the symptoms sound rather like a sort of what's called a toxic confusional state that occurs after, you know, some people get a high fever and they get a toxic confusional state. It's worrying that she still has these persistent symptoms. Rubella virus has been linked to autism historically. Mothers who contract rubella during pregnancy have a higher rate of autism in their children, which comes to a question that someone else asked. The question is, what can be done? Many people have published on the links between childhood autism, which used to be called childhood schizophrenia, and later onset schizophrenia or schizoid problems, and the response to a gluten-free diet. It's been very, very interesting that in both instances, controlled trials have shown that there is demonstrable benefit in people from a gluten-free diet. And I think that's likely to be even more the case now, because the gluten that we eat now is not the gluten that our grandparents ate. Since the advent of GMO crops and a failure in that, which was the dwarf wheat, it is now highly toxic, I'm told by the experts. It is very indigestible and highly allergenic in the gut, capable of causing much more inflammation. In fact, there's a new condition that's been described by American gastroenterologists called non-celiac disease gluten enteropathy, in other words, a bowel disease that is not celiac disease. So my recommendation to this mother, if it's possible, is to try instituting a gluten-free diet. This used to be extremely difficult, but now, because of consumer demand, you can find aisles of consumer-free food in all major supermarkets, not just Whole Foods. And it has to be 100%. But in terms of practically doing something to help this girl, I think a non-medical, a non-drug intervention would be the right approach in the first instance, and a 100% strict, maintained gluten-free diet may well help. So that would be my suggestion there. Let's start with a tough one. Many people say Dr. Wakefield was discredited in his research. Can you please refute that to help me know how to refute that argument? There are several books on this now. Mine, of course, is written by me and would say that, wouldn't it? But the best book comes from an EPA scientist called Dr. David Lewis, who was a very senior scientist at the EPA. He now heads up the National Whistleblowers Association. He was extremely respected, published in Nature and Science and The Lancet. And he took all of our data and independently analyzed it in the face of Brian Deer's allegations of fraud. And he did a systematic analysis of the data, and he showed, in fact, that the fraud was quite clearly on the part of the British Medical Journal and Brian Deer. So he was given access to all of the original data from the Lancet study. So Dr. Lewis then published a book called Science for Sale, and that is available on Amazon. So if you want to read a sort of exoneration of the Lancet study by a senior scientist, then that is the place to go. That's perhaps the most objective evidence you will have. In addition, you can go to the court documents in Travis County, which I wouldn't recommend. It's quite a laborious process, but those court documents again show without a shadow of a doubt that there was fraud on the part of Brian Deer and the BMJ. And I think what they've done is consider that I was zero risk for litigation since I was financially destitute at the time, and that therefore they could write effectively what they like. And of course, it takes 5 minutes to destroy a scientist's career and a lifetime or more to restore it. So that's where that lies. A couple of related questions. Has there been any research on the possible relation between MTHFR genes and vaccines? And another one saying the same thing. Do you have any idea whether infants with MTHFR gene mutations can detoxify or handle vaccines safely? MTHFR, methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase, is an enzyme that's involved in detoxification. And yes, some work has been done on this by the late Jeff Bradstreet and others, showing that the prevalence of mutations in that gene are higher in the parents and in children with autism than those without. And that's extremely interesting because it suggests that some fundamental biological mechanism involved in detoxifying our bodies puts people at risk of autism and related problems. So the work has been done. Please Google Scholar the word Bradstreet and you will pull that information out. What is your advice for vaccine-injured children with autism? Wow, that's a huge question. It operates on so many different levels, legal levels, biological levels, medical levels, what to do. I think there is a great deal of information out there now. What I would do is, in the first instance, a set of highly accessible videos about autism are available on the Autism Media Channel, which is what I'm part of now. And they were made by Polly Tommy, the mother of an affected child, and they were how to and what to do and a practical guide to parents. So autismmediachannel.com, you can find a lot of that information in simple, easy to listen to, short video format. And there are a number of other resources out there that are cited within the Autism Media Channel. So that is a very good resource. CARD, the Center for Autism and Related Disorders, which is out of California, but run nationally, is a very good ABA provider for autism. I don't know whether they're here in Utah. Someone may know. But they also have a series of very useful videos on their website. Just as on a practical note, the thing that I have found to be most helpful, as in the first instance, and something that is conservative, it's not drug intervention, and that is trying a period of gluten casein exclusion from the diet. This is something that we started after parents put us onto this back in 1998 at the Royal Free, and it was remarkable, the benefit that children got from that. It has to be sustained. It has to be 100%. There can't be infractions. And one of the most telling or compelling pieces of information that we found was when children were on a diet, and then they had an infraction. They went to a party and had a cookie or something. Then for the next week, they were utterly miserable and very, very badly behaved. And this exposure, re-exposure phenomenon we saw time and again, and that was extremely convincing. So as a non-medical, non-drug intervention that is cheap and accessible and in the control of the parents' hands, then that is a very good approach. Are there any vaccines you feel are safe and effective? You know, since my work was based upon the parental story, what we heard initially in the UK was MMR, and because MMR was given in isolation at 15 to 18 months with no other vaccines, it was easy for the parents to identify that as what they believed to be the trigger. But the more I've gone into this, I then came to this country and I heard people talking about the thimerosal, the mercuryin vaccines, and now aluminum and all of the things that you've heard from my fellow speaker. The more you learn, the more worried you become. And then I learned the other day that in the rotavirus vaccine made by SmithKline Beecham, or GlaxoSmithKline now, they discovered that there were DNA fragments from a pig virus, porcine circovirus type 1. And the FDA took the step of removing that vaccine from the market until the risks of that were known. It was then discovered using the same technology that in the Merck vaccine, rotavirus vaccine, there were two pig virus DNAs, porcine circovirus type 1 and 2. And type 2 was a disease-causing agent in young pigs. They didn't expect them to be there. They were discovered to be there. There was this extraneous DNA about which they knew nothing in terms of its safety, nothing at all. It should not be given to children at all. But what they did is take the step then of putting both vaccines back on the market. I will never, ever understand the logic of that, except that there must have been huge industry pressure to do so. They said, it's clear that the benefits outweigh the risks. They didn't even know it was there, let alone what the risks were. So these are the people, these are the guardians, these are the gatekeepers. So do I believe there are any vaccines that meet the criteria of protecting children against serious infectious disease that are safe and effective? No. Discuss human fetal cells in vaccines. Yes, for some vaccines, I think the rubella was one of the first. Then the virus was grown on cells from an aborted fetus, and that is the cell line that is now used. And clearly, that may be a difficulty for many, many people. Is there a possibility that vaccines could trigger autoimmune disease? Yes, absolutely. This is well established. If you want to look up a world authority on this, Yehuda Schoenfeld from Tel Aviv, professor of immunology and the editor of the journal Autoimmunity, has described this in great detail and has actually described a new autoimmune syndrome associated with what he believes to be the aluminum in vaccines. So Yehuda Schoenfeld is the name to look up there. Do you have any data or knowledge about the connection between vaccines and cancer? I don't. That's a short answer. It's not been my field, and so I'm sorry, I can't help on that one. How do we educate our pediatricians? When you watch this documentary, when it comes out in April, we want it to have a major impact upon the election process. There are two well-known television pediatricians on there, and part of the documentary is the arc of their story, coming from a position of believing the CDC, allowing the CDC to mandate their day-to-day practice, believing it, telling it to their patients, saying it on television, reading the documents that describe the fraud, and coming to a very different conclusion at the end. And so the way in which to educate your pediatricians is to have them watch their colleagues go through that process in the movie, and then they will understand. In your estimation, what is the strongest platform we can unite to fight mandatory vaccination? It is, in California, they fought on the basis of, there were huge dissent and faction forming amongst various groups who said, we want to fight it on this, we want to fight it on that. In the end, the faction that won fought it on the basis of choice. If you fight it on the basis of choice, the politicians have already been presented with the argument that the choice of the mass exceeds the choice of the individual. Now, even though that is fundamentally flawed and totalitarian in its thinking, that is what they were up against. So you got into a debate, and they were always going to lose that debate. The way you fight it is the plank of the argument for mandatory vaccination is that they are safe and effective. You have seen tonight that for one vaccine alone, it is neither safe nor effective, and therefore they cannot win that argument. So please fight it on the basis that this is not safe and not effective, and here are the reasons why. Federal and corporate admissions of fraud. What damage is done to 18 and 19-year-old youth who are vaccinated for the first time before leaving on an LDS foreign mission? I heard a tragic story today of one such child, one such young man who died after a flu shot. Perfectly healthy. You may know this story. But he was going off on a mission and he died within days of the flu shot. Again, where there is risk, there must be choice. And we had this discussion that the church here insists that despite one of the great tenets of your faith being that that choice, I think there's a word for it, but thank you, yes, is absolutely fundamental to your beliefs, then when it pertains to vaccines, suddenly that has gone. That is extraordinary to me. Yes, this lady here. Okay, right. But once again, you know, you are removing the choice of going to a foreign country if you mandate that people are vaccinated when they don't want to be. And so, again, where there is risk, there must be choice. And so there can be no mandatory vaccination under any circumstances. What are the benefits of natural immunity ignored even by a lot of people in the vaccine choice movement? Well, there is a belief, a common belief, that if you are exposed to the natural infection, then you develop stronger immunity and lifelong immunity. And there are some interesting caveats to that argument, but one of the most powerful observations is that mothers who had natural measles conferred upon their infants until a year, 18 months, very good immunity, very good protection during that period of susceptibility. Mothers who have been vaccinated against measles do not. And that protection is much shorter and much less effective, putting infants under the age of one at risk of measles precisely because of the vaccine program. So there is one of the unintended consequences of the vaccine. So natural immunity is there for a reason, and I have come to believe that it is extremely important. Please tell us about your 10 colleagues. In The Lancet, there were 13 authors, senior scientists, many of them top in their field in the country or in the world. The Lancet editor, after Brian Deer made his allegations, wanted us to write a retraction of an interpretation that MMR vaccine caused autism. Not a retraction of the science in the paper, but a retraction of the association between MMR and autism. But as I've said earlier, we didn't make that association. We explicitly said this paper does not prove an association. So how can you retract something that's not been said? But my colleagues were intimidated and they were concerned for their reputations and they signed a retraction. Three of us refused. That's really where that was left. What do you know about healing food allergies that resulted from vaccine damage? Again, the best way to deal with food allergies is by exclusion. And there are anti-inflammatory agents, but I become more and more averse to medical intervention when there are safer alternatives, and that is through adequate testing and appropriate exclusion diets. So that would be my approach. This is a very long question. Your beer can be found... No, it doesn't say that. Dr. Wakefield. The core of the question is here. Okay. Is it possible that rubella vaccine I was given and still show dubious immunity will be active in my gut and therefore have put her at risk of autism? So, let me read the whole thing. I do not show immunity to the rubella portion of the MMR. I was given it at 17, my first child at 20, and then at 22. I came chronically ill with swollen glands and outbreaks of rashes. I miscarried at 12 weeks on my next child and then was able to have more children. I have a baby in 2013. 20 months later, regressed into autism-like symptoms after a virus. She's unvaccinated. Is it possible that the rubella vaccine was given? You know, with viruses, the truth is anything is possible. And I do hear these stories. One of the questions here, which I'll deal with in this context, is are there children who have autism who are unvaccinated? And here you have your answer, yes, there are. Historically, autism was caused by a number of different exposures: congenital rubella, congenital syphilis, toxoplasmosis, cytomegalovirus, mothers who took sodium valproate for seizures during pregnancy, mothers who took misoprostol for illegal abortions in countries like Brazil. And all of these things operated in utero, and that therefore the baby was born with autism-like features very early on. And the difference in pattern now is that children regress. They seem to develop normally during the first 12 to 15 months and then regress. So the pattern of autism has changed. But could the scenario that this lady has articulated be true? Yes, indeed. And how to establish that would be by direct testing, either testing for measles, for rubella virus in the gut, and looking at antibody levels. But it's a story that I haven't heard before, but I'm continually surprised. Are there dangers associated with the hepatitis B vaccine? We're concerned because we've heard that hepatitis B is highly contagious. Hepatitis B, in the first world, in this country, is a disease of drug abuse, of contaminated intravenous products, and sexual promiscuity. It was recommended for children on the first day of life for no reason whatsoever other than to make money. It is the most heinous crime, I believe. And when Dr. Neil Halsey, one of the architects of medical vaccination policy in this country, was asked in a public meeting in Louisiana, why would you give this vaccine to a one-day-old child? It's got mercury in it, and this child is not going to be exposed to those risk factors, if ever, until they're a teenager. Why would you do that? And he said, because we can. That is the scientific basis for hepatitis B vaccine on the first day of life, because we can. That is the exquisite arrogance of these people. And now their argument is, well, if we give it early on, if we get children into the vaccine program early on, then they're more compliant to stay in that program. So nothing to do with the health of the child at all. This is nothing to do with protecting the child from hepatitis B. So hepatitis B is a highly infectious disease if you are exposed in the appropriate way, but babies are not exposed unless their mother is positive for hepatitis B, and that can be screened for, so those people might selectively be given the vaccine. Otherwise, it is just a money-making machine. What can we do locally to stop mandatory vaccinations? You must prevail upon your politicians. You must do that. Are you afraid for your life, considering the recent deaths? The late Jeff Bradstreet, who I mentioned about in the MTHFR mutations, was found shot in the chest and drowned in a river, and the police said there were no suspicious circumstances. And following him, another at least 10 doctors who were involved in alternative medicine vaccine research have been killed or died under very suspicious circumstances. Jeff was about to present some information, I believe, on vaccines, inflammation, autism, and treatments, particularly cancer treatments as well. He had a story to tell that someone clearly did not want to be told. Do I think about it occasionally? Do I worry about it? No. Someone asked me if I'd received any threats. The people we're dealing with don't threaten. Okay, that doesn't happen. You know, is it going to change anything I do? No. Nelson Mandela said in his trial that some ideals are worth dying for, and I believe that your children are worth dying for, so if that's who it comes to. Yeah. What percent of SIDS cases would you figure are primarily vaccine-related there? Yes, this question of children dying soon after DPT vaccines, multiple vaccines, there are many, many such cases. They make the news, often given 9-10 vaccines on the same day to 4-month-old children. Absolutely extraordinary. Never been tested for safety in the history of this planet. And the death is put down to sudden infant death syndrome, no link to the vaccine. That is clearly unacceptable. I believe that a great majority of those deaths may well be vaccine related. Why does Merck insist on putting all three vaccines in one dose, the MMR? Why? Because it was a commercial strategy that gave them a monopoly. There were two producers of the measles vaccine in this country. Merck had a mumps vaccine. They reasoned that if they could combine it with the rubella, put it into a triple vaccine, and no one else had a mumps vaccine, they would get a monopoly, and that is exactly what happened. They put their competitor out of business. What is your knowledge about Nagalase and GM-CSF? This is the GC-MAF. This is the work that Jeff Bradstreet was doing. I'm not an expert. In fact, I was kind of removed from the scientific arena before this work became popular. I heard Jeff talking about it at the last Autism One meeting. It was most interesting, but it's not my field of expertise. But I would suggest to you that there is clearly something in it. Do you have any information on the flu vaccine? It's a complete waste of time and money. It doesn't work. The people who get it, when they do get flu afterwards, they have a greater rate of hospitalization, much more serious disease. And there have been three studies out of Canada showing not only that fact, but the reason for that they believe to be correct. So it is a money spinner. It is ineffective and unsafe. The GAPS diet, I'm afraid I'm not an expert in. What about the children and grandchildren of the perpetrators of this fraud? Surely they must have autism in their families. I don't know. It's a good question. I think Frank DiStefano has a child with intellectual disabilities. He was the lead author and the main fraud on this paper. And I hope that he'll be called to account for that. Right, at the end. We're at the end. Please ask people to send emails to Congressman Chavez, so that he has a paper trail to show proof of support. That is an absolute obligation on the part of every person in this room. Absolutely imperative that these people are brought to account, that the truth comes out, and that your children have a safer future. Thank you.
He got his bar location. All right, he's a happy man. Thanks again for coming, everybody. If you'd help us with the cheers, we'd appreciate it, and we'll see you next month. Thank you.